Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, April 11th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll feature dispatches on the national elections in Chad, where the incumbent president appears to have secured another term of office. An aid agency has been attacked in the northeastern region of the West African state of Nigeria. We'll have details on that as well. The West African state of Benin is also undergoing an election today, while the existing administration of President Patrice Talon is attempting to remain in power. And the East African state of Uganda is signing another deal to expand an oil pipeline important to the development of the country. In the second hour, there is a news report providing details on a number of contemporary issues in Africa and the international community in general. Finally, we pay tribute to Paul Robeson, who was an artist, actor, social scientist, and activist. On the 123rd anniversary of his birth, which took place just 2 days ago, these and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Famuna alla coro si la tamma chobo Sai malinu na coro si la tamma filamen Alubaki wala coro dogwara te dia ni kumale folla Alubaki wala coro dogwara te yarabi kumale folla Olura pobi Nekeyemde
Devenir parano dans l'autre monde, l'on peut tous avoir ce mérite de parrainer, ouais parrainer, tous poussés entre goudron, trottoir, rotation d'une population dans ce laboratoire. Tu sais que beaucoup trop font le plongeon, beaucoup trop de pigeons aux élections, de mon balcon, je ne vois que des corbeaux, ouais, pour ainsi dire à tous, j'aimerais leur mettre la corde au. Après des semaines, ce cycle de vie, cela faisait des siècles que l'on n'avait pas revu. La sensation de profiter de tout ce qui fitait. Vraie première récompense, boulot fin pété, tout ce que rien ne pourra compenser.
Thank you. I want Mon frère dit la vérité. Nya fola, mansa te wiko. Kanke lentigi, mansa te wiko. Tu nya fo, mansa te wiko. Nana sila. Kera mansa ye.
Nya fosa.
Ikera fonsa ye.
Nya fosa.
Aliba ke bolokolo.
Nya fosa.
Tunya fo gelema adon fo tunya efo.
Tunya fo tunya fo tunya fo sa.
Tunya fo gelema adon fo tunya efo.
Tunya fo tunya fo tunya fo sa. Tunya fo tunya fo ite tunya fo. Amen anya wonya tunya benalon.
Amen anya wonya tunya benalon.
Batoto yake, tani kandana
linda ye kosua.
Regani
mulemba shangola. Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola.
Kasanzu wabishila, menekenu mukwenu. Kubaza kwa mushime, menekenu kubaza.
Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola. Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola.
Ayuwe Luanda. Ayuwe Angola. Ayuwe Bahia. Estu mudete.
Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola. Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola.
Mulembera milena, Damaria Kalundu, Angola ritual, Africa no solo tu.
Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola. Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola.
Salvador da tradição, mulemba shangola.
Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola. Mulemba shangola. Ayuwe mulemba shangola.
One more.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, a special edition of our program, and that was a compilation of music from various parts of the African continent. The album is entitled African Party Collection, and right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. Our lead story deals with the political situation in the western Central African state of Chad. Chadian President Idriss Déby Itno was widely expected to win re-election earlier today, extending his three-decade-long rule in this Central African nation after three top opposition politicians chose not to take part in the election. Some polling stations opened later than expected in the capital of N'Djamena, where streets are lined with giant portraits of Déby. A constitutional referendum approved several years ago means he can now serve two more terms, potentially staying in power until 2033. In Nigeria, suspected Islamist extremists attacked the offices of several international aid groups, setting them ablaze and renewing concerns earlier today about the safety of humanitarian workers in Nigeria's embattled northeast. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attacks in Damasak town late last night, but suspicion immediately fell on a faction of extremists aligned with the Islamic State group. Last year, the militants warned Nigerians they would become targets along with foreigners if they insisted international aid groups or the military. Edward Cologne, United Nations resident and humanitarian coordinator in Nigeria, expressed concern for civilians and aid workers on Sunday in the wake of the overnight attack. Humanitarian operations in Damasak will be reduced due to the violent attack, which will affect the support of 8,800 internally displaced persons and 76,000 people in the host community receiving humanitarian assistance and protection there. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Also in Benin, in West Africa, voters cast ballots today in a presidential election that has been marred by violent demonstrations as incumbent leader Patrice Talon ran for a second term despite once pledging he would not. The opposition said the vote was going forward without a number of top challengers, including one from the party of former President Boni Yayi, who was disqualified from taking part. Over the past week, protests have erupted in several cities across Benin, particularly in those favorable to the former president. Election officials warned late yesterday that the unrest had disrupted the arrival of election materials in some localities and that voting operations would start late in affected areas in northern Benin. As a candidate in 2016, Talon promised that 5 years in the presidency would be enough, but later decided to run for a second term. He faced two challengers in Sunday's vote, international orator Alassane Soumanou and civil administrator Corentine Kuhau. And finally, in Uganda, Tanzania, and the French oil company Total have signed agreements, they did this earlier today, on building a heated pipeline to carry crude oil from western Uganda to the Indian Ocean coast. Construction of the pipeline, which would be the world's longest at 897 miles, is expected to begin this year. Tanzania's new leader, President Samia Suluhu Hassan, was in Uganda to witness the signing of the documents, perhaps her most important executive action since her inauguration last month. Ugandan authorities and officials from Total, a majority shareholder in Uganda's oil fields, also signed the agreements that had been long held up by the tax disputes, administrative delays, and the death of Hassan's predecessor. Suluhu described the event as an auspicious occasion that would unlock development of the region's oil resources. The shareholder agreements cover the construction of the $3.5 billion pipeline designed to connect oil fields near Lake Albert to the Tanzanian seaport of Tanga. Despite anxiety over the falling crude prices in recent years, hopes have remained high in Uganda over the potential for oil exports to lift the East African country into upper middle income status by 2040. Annual per capita income in Uganda was less than $800 in 2019. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to our blog at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you would like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for today, or for any other days in the past, all you have to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And the programs can be shared with other potential listeners via email, through blogs and websites, as well as social media networks. And right now, we want to, of course, take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
You know, I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life. Is all I had at in a parade of centuries. People cried out and said, please, please, will I speed up liberation and just some help in this civilization? And though I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life. So like that, what did they do? What did they say to justify speaking sway? And they just fought and often cried, and when they turned around, were shot down and died. Oh, but I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life. Zola had that, Munchie and John walked through this maze. They touched a million lives in a thousand ways, 3 score and 10. Never knew them. 26 and 23, it's all the worst. Oh, can't you see? Didn't you hear the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a light. All I had.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast, a special edition of our program for Sunday, April 11th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and that was the voice of Elaine Brown, the Black Panther Party, from the album entitled Seize the Time. Right now, we want to move into a news broadcast from CGTN. Deals with a lot of information about contemporary developments on the African continent and throughout the international community. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Signs of hope in Xinjiang as rescuers rush to save 21 people trapped underground in a mine accident. Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu in Uganda in her first foreign trip as president. And held an environmental concerns rise as Japan plans to dump radioactive water from Fukushima into the sea. Hello and thank you for joining us on Africa Live. I am Penina Karibe. Let's have a look at the stories coming up this hour. Suez Canal blockage lessens. Experts call for backup plans for global supply chain. And in sports, we look at the success story of Zimbabwe qualifying for the Africa for the AFCON finals despite financial constraints and the COVID-19 pandemic. Voting is currently underway in Benin as citizens elect their president. This follows weeks of violent protests in a country seen as highly stable and with a robust democracy. President Patrice Talon is widely expected to secure a second term in office. Talon is facing two relatively little-known opposition candidates. These are Alassane Soumanou, who was a minister under former President Thomas Boni Yayi, and Corentin Kohou, a veteran politician. After the 2019 parliamentary elections, there was nationwide unrest, and the opposition called for demonstrations in the capital, Cotonou. The protests were triggered by the Election Commission imposing restrictions preventing opposition parties from fielding candidates. To northwest China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, where 8 people have been rescued and 21 are still trapped after a coal mine was flooded. All of the trapped men have been located. The accident happened around 6 p.m. Saturday. 29 workers were upgrading the mine in Hutubi County in the Hui Autonomous Prefecture of Changji in the north of Xinjiang. Crews are pumping out water as flooding continues. The local authority says there is a possibility of survival as air can accumulate in some areas inside the mine. Now, gun salutes across the UK have marked the death of Britain's Prince Philip. Military leaders honoured the former naval officer who served as royal consort to his wife, Queen Elizabeth II, for 73 years. He died on Friday at Windsor Castle, just 2 months before what would have been his 100th birthday. Naveed Jabakil reports from London.
Fire! Fire! Fire!
From London to Edinburgh, Cardiff to Belfast, across the UK, the cannons fired out. A 41-round gun salute paying tribute to Prince Philip. Outside Buckingham Palace, things looking a lot quieter than they did when news first broke of his death at the age of 99. Both the palace and the government urged people to stay away and avoid physical tributes because of COVID-19. But some, young and old, still choosing to turn out.
We just wanted to come and show our support and really show the kids, you know, that it's important to show your respect.
What a loyal guy. I mean, the guy had a top career in the Royal Navy and he gave it up to be the number two to his wife.
I think he'll be remembered as a public servant, an inspiration, and, you know, I think of him and the Queen and a wonderful love story that they had for, you know, 73 years of marriage.
Tributes are continuing to pour in from around the world too, among them China's President Xi Jinping sending a message of condolence. As the news continues to sink in, attention's turning to the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral, where once again the impact of the coronavirus is being felt. There'll be no state funeral, and his body will not lie in state for the public to pay their respects. Instead, a smaller, private affair, something the royal family says was in line with Prince Philip's wishes.
For almost 70 years, the Duke of Edinburgh accompanied Queen Elizabeth throughout her reign. During the many highs and lows, he was a trusted voice to the British monarch, even if publicly he was often a few steps behind her. For now, the sense of national mourning continues here after the loss of a monumental figure in the country's recent history. Naweed Jabarkil, CGTN, London.
In the European Union, concerns about side effects from vaccines are growing. Europe's drug regulator is expanding its probe into the AstraZeneca vaccine to include a bleeding condition. The European Medicines Agency is also looking into Johnson & Johnson's jabs after four serious cases of blood clots are reported. Rahul Patak reports from Madrid.
In Spain, vaccine hesitancy has been on the rise, following the change in guidance from the government on who can receive the AstraZeneca vaccine. Earlier this week, health officials approved its use for those between 60 and 69. Since then, Madrid residents have been reluctant to come forward, with only around 45% of those asked having confirmed their appointments. The government is now trying to offer reassurance.
From a political point of view, our decisions will always be absolutely based on scientific and technical criteria to guarantee, firstly, the lives of our people and our country's public health, and also to ensure the vaccination process is a success.
Well, previously, the big issue in Spain, like much of the rest of Europe, was one of vaccine supply. Well, supply lines have now increased, so the main challenge is to change public perception on safety so that as many people get vaccinated as possible.
In France, Emmanuel Macron visited Delpharm, the first COVID-19 vaccine production plant in France, which he hopes will deliver tens of millions of bottles of vaccine by the end of the year.
What we have seen this morning, in concrete terms for our fellow citizens, are these doses of the Pfizer biotech vaccine produced here and then sent to vaccination centers to be used by our fellow citizens and also delivered to our European neighbors.
As Europe looks to ramp up its supply, representatives of the European Medicines Agency, EMA, are visiting Russia to review the country's Sputnik V vaccine. Previously, an official from the European body urged caution in approval at a national level as they continue a rolling review of the drug. Meanwhile, some more bad news for the Anglo-Swedish AstraZeneca vaccine after Hong Kong announced a suspension in its use. Authorities there say they will wait until an upgraded second-generation version of the drug becomes available, as it may be better suited to protect its residents against the new virus variants of the COVID-19 strain. Rahul Pathak, CDTN, Madrid.
And the link between AstraZeneca vaccine and cases of blood clots has been confirmed in Germany and Norway. A report by a German disease control agency shows blood clots have appeared in 42 people who received AstraZeneca shots. The country's vaccine regulator said it will stick to the guidance of limiting the vaccine to those aged over 60. Norwegian state media said medical research showed 5 confirmed COVID-19 patients have suffered from the same side effects and also low platelets. Norway halted the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine last month. The Tanzanian government says it intends to set up a committee of experts to evaluate the COVID-19 pandemic and advise the government on the way forward. President Samia Suluhu says the country cannot continue to be silent on the issue and also cannot rely only on external reports on the pandemic. CGTN's Daniel Kijo has more.
Tanzania is looking to re-strategize its fight against the COVID-19 virus. President Hassan has revealed she will form a committee of experts to advise her government on how to combat the COVID-19 virus. Tanzania last released data on COVID-19 almost a year ago, with data then showing the country only had 509 cases.
Watuambie upeo.
They will tell us the full impact of the COVID-19 issue, and they will advise us on the various remedies that we are being advised to use. Are they good for us? We want to find this out for ourselves. We don't want people to see ... when people read global COVID-19 reports, which creates uncertainty. We must be clear on where we stand.
The exact details of how the committee will be formed are yet to be revealed. President Hassan took office last month after the death of John Magufuli, her predecessor. Experts say this move to form a fresh committee could be a shift from the government's earlier handling of the disease's presence in the country.
There have been a lot of call for Tanzania to act in accordance to the World Health Organization guidelines, of which there is a feeling that we are not following those procedures and protocols, which has made an image of Tanzania like we are acting as an island.
Unlike her neighbors, Tanzania did not lock down. It required people to wear masks and practice social distancing. Later, it removed restrictions on gatherings and encouraged people to use herbal remedies, steam themselves, and do physical exercises. After pressure from the World Health Organization, the country acknowledged in February that it was dealing with cases of the disease. While the country is eligible for free vaccines from COVAX, the global COVID-19 initiative, late President Magufuli's administration took no steps to receive doses. So many are waiting to see if President Hassan's committee will decide to join its East African neighbors Kenya, Rwanda and Uganda and get its citizens vaccinated. Daniel Kijo, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
Tunisian President Kais Saied is on a three-day state visit to Egypt. It's the first official trip for Saied to Cairo. On Saturday, the two countries announced deepening ties in all fields. It's significant progress in relations between the countries, which were tense under former Tunisian President Beji Caid Essebsi. Here's Adel Mahri with more.
Egypt has rolled out an elegant reception in the honor of Tunisian President Kais Saied in Cairo. Meeting between the two countries' leaders mark a new beginning after years of tension between the two nations over Libya and Egypt's crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has an active political party in Tunisia. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi announced a plan of comprehensive cooperation between the two nations in all fields and regional issues.
And reaching the closeness between the two states and the two brotherly people is our aim, taking into consideration the common challenges that Egypt and Tunisia are facing, on top of which is achieving comprehensive development, facing negative foreign interference in the region, preventing restraints over national institutions, and fighting terrorism and extremism.
The two leaders confirmed their identical stances in nearly all topics discussed in Cairo. They've also vowed to support one another in international gatherings, particularly with the UN Security Council. Tunisia is this year's Arab representative on the Council, which Egypt will soon approach to discuss the failure of the Nile water talks.
Concerning the fair distribution of water, Egypt's national security is our security. Egypt's stance on any international gathering will be our stance. We will not allow any tampering to Egypt's water security. Egypt is talking about a fair solution.
Egypt and Tunisia used to support rival Libyan factions. For the first time since the conflict sparked in 2011, they both voiced support for the same leadership in Libya. They discussed means to support the unity government's mission to hold elections in their common neighbor.
There has been like a tripartite presidential initiative to reach a comprehensive political settlement in Libya between Egypt, Algeria and Tunis. And I think that now Tunis has seen how Egypt played a vital role in this fight. So it wants to like further combine efforts with Egypt to end, for example, or curb the foreign intervention in Libya and also to combat like the militant groups.
Boosting economic ties was an integral part of the talks. Both leaders expressed their desire to develop business ties so they can be as strong as their political relations. Furthermore, President Sisi and President Saied declared that 2021 and 2022 is going to be a year of Egyptian-Tunisian culture. Through it, the two nations hope to host popular events to strengthen ties between their people and spread a culture of tolerance to face extremism and terrorist ideologies, which the two leaders say their countries suffer from. Adel Mahroui, CGTN, Cairo.
You're watching Africa Live. Let's take a short break coming up. Muslims prepare for the holy month of Ramadan, which is expected to begin on Tuesday. And too sleepy all the time? Well, check if you have a treatable sleeping disorder.
How will your world change today? What happens here? What happens there? Or what you make happen for yourself? If it matters to you, it matters to us too. Your stories are the stories that need to be told. Africa Live. Find your voice.
Nigeria is my home. 160 million vibrant, ambitious individuals constantly seeking the perfect self-expression. It is these people who inspired me to be that person that is seen, to be a voice that is heard, and ultimately to be the anchor that I am. I have to tap in, tune in, and turn on the very best qualities within me to deliver the news. I'm Richard Nta, an anchor for CGTN.
I try to not let it affect me, but there are days when it does. I'm a human being, and to see patients in a hospital bed and their family members are not there, there's no one there to hold their hand, that human touch, you know?
I just hope everyone can remember that the situation is not permanent and that everything will get better eventually.
Health and environmental concerns are growing over Japan's plan to dump a massive amount of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. The wastewater is from the Fukushima nuclear accident 10 years ago. It's been treated but is still radioactive. The government is expected to make a formal announcement soon. Phoebe Amoroso has more from Tokyo.
Last year, a government advisory panel gave them with two different options with how to deal with this waste. One was to evaporate it, and the second option was to release it slowly into the sea. Now, they made several provisions based on this. The idea would be to dilute it to 1/40th of the set national safety standards. And then release it slowly over 3 decades. So there's said to be no impact on human health. However, there is very strong opposition from the fisheries.
Some experts suggest nuclear wastewater be poured into the ocean. There is no support for this among fishery workers and the Japanese public. I strongly oppose this idea as well.
A survey earlier this month or last month said that 51% of the public are strongly against the waste being released, and 18%, only 18% are in favour. There is a very strong anti-nuclear sentiment here in Japan. Now, one of the reasons why the government is trying to make this decision now is that currently more than 100 tons of groundwater are leaking into the basements of the damaged reactors. Now, this is mixing with radioactive debris, and TEPCO, who manages the facilities, they are purifying this, but it leaves behind tritium. So this wastewater, it has to be stored somewhere, and they're running out of capacity. It's said to be reaching capacity around autumn 2022. So there is some pressure on to make a decision quickly, because even if they do release the water into the sea, it's going to take about 2 years of preparation.
The United Nations Nuclear Agency is showing support for Japan's plan to dump the wastewater into the sea. The International Atomic Energy Agency says releasing nuclear water into the ocean is a standard practice globally. Japan had asked the agency to assess its plan, but the country's neighbors, including China, are still urging for caution.
The radioactive leakage from Japan's Fukushima nuclear accident has already had a profound impact on the marine environment, food safety, and human health. the Japanese government should take a responsible attitude to its nationals, neighboring countries, and the international community, conduct an in-depth assessment of the potential impact of the treatment for wastewater containing tritium at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, voluntarily disclose information in a strictly accurate, open, and transparent manner, and make cautious decisions on the basis of full consultation with neighboring countries.
South Korea is separated from Japan by the Sea of Japan. Jack Barton is in Seoul. He reports on the public reactions to Tokyo's plan to release wastewater.
South Korea is one of those 15 countries we heard about that does have an import ban on a number of agricultural and seafood products from Japan because of the Fukushima accident, and it's been gravely concerned about this situation all along. And in terms of public opinion, this is one subject that really is, it is widespread. The majority of South Koreans oppose this decision. The opposition parties and the main ruling party are essentially on the same page, and it's one issue that pretty much everyone is unified on at the moment in their opposition. The government's been making strong comments about this since 2019. President Moon Jae-in's government says it's gravely aware and there is serious concern. It's called for transparency about the entire process. And the Ministry of Fisheries and Oceans here says this shouldn't be a sovereign decision by Japan. It should be an international decision, particularly, input from countries in the region, even though that the US and France and, as we heard before, the International Atomic Energy Agency have indicated that they believe, this could go ahead. The other big concern here, again, as we just heard, is this wouldn't be a one-off event. This would be the beginning of a process. Fukushima has 1,100 tons, so once this process begins, it will have to continue beginning the release of this water into the ocean.
Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu is in Uganda in her first official trip abroad since becoming president. Top of the agenda is the construction of an oil pipeline between the two countries. Last September, the two countries signed an agreement that will see construction of a 1,445-kilometer pipeline that will connect Uganda's oil fields to Tanzania's port of Tanga. Oil reserves were discovered in Uganda in 2006, but production has been delayed by a lack of infrastructure. Muslims around the world are preparing to mark the start of Ramadan beginning Tuesday. Ramadan is the most sacred month in Islamic culture and is marked by a period of intense prayer, dawn-to-dusk fasting and nightly feasts. CGTN's Yasser Hakim looks at the preparations being made ahead of the start of the holy month.
Aware of the economic challenges being faced by the low and middle income earners due to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, Egypt's government has established markets countrywide to sell basic goods at discounted prices ahead of the holy month of Ramadan. The fairs, called Ahlan Ramadan or Welcome Ramadan, are handy during this period as people stock up on groceries and dates.
Our aim is to provide the basic necessities to the people during the holy month of Ramadan. We provide all types of goods, including food and cleaning products. There are 171 companies selling everything from cooking oil to meat and fish. The private sector, state-owned national services companies, the military services, the Ministry of Interior Company, and the state holding company are all here selling products at competitive prices.
Ramadan in Egypt had its own traditions, which include families and friends gathering every day to eat after long hours of fasting. Prices of food and sweets naturally increase at this time, which makes Welcome Ramadan markets popular.
I heard about this fair and its discounts in the media, and because the purchases for Ramadan are many, I decided to come with my parents to buy things like cooking oil and various types of food. The offers are very good. I didn't expect prices to be so low here. I'm impressed with the variety too. The basic commodities sold here are rice, vegetables, beans, cleaning materials, and then there are special sweets we eat after iftar.
I bought rice, pasta, sugar, tea and other stuff like soup, salt and many other stuff we use throughout the month. It's better buying here because you find everything in one place and at competitive prices.
The government has doubled the number of Ramadan fairs this year to counter the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Last year, the fair was cancelled because of the coronavirus pandemic, but this year the government went ahead with it, and that is really good, as it has created high demand and stimulated the market. We produce all types of liquid cleaners, home care, vehicle cleaning and textile cleaning as well. We are offering 40% to 60% discount on our products.
We prefer during the Welcome Ramadan fair to sell food products, all basics for Ramadan meals as well as some home cleaning products. There is no doubt we have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The food product to a lesser extent, but everything else is still very much affected.
The Welcome Ramadan fairs are not just supporting the consumers, but are also giving a boost to the market for producers and sellers who have faced tough times due to the pandemic-induced economic fallout. Yes, Hakim, for CGTN, Cairo.
People living with sleep disorders battle their condition as they try to lead normal lives. Narcolepsy, which is one of these disorders, is a condition where patients have excessive, uncontrollable daytime sleepiness and may suddenly fall asleep at any time during any type of activity. CGTN's Wukis Tanyabo spent some time with a person living with narcolepsy and filed the following report.
When Miriam steps into the doctor's office, she comes with high hopes and great expectations.
Sockets for recording the brain.
That's because his office offers answers to questions others may not be able to answer. Dr. Peter Mudenji is a clinical physiologist, and his work involves diagnosing sleep disorders. Marianne is living with narcolepsy, a chronic sleep disorder characterized by overwhelming daytime drowsiness and sudden attacks of sleep.
It's a disorder whose origin is the brain. The problem of narcolepsy is characterized by several things. One of them is excessive sleepiness during the day. In other words, your kind of sleepiness which you are not able to control.
Patients may also lose control of their muscles. Marianne first started to exhibit the symptoms while in high school.
Sometimes when I'm taking breakfast, I could doze off without knowing. And then also when walking to school, I used to fall asleep while walking. Like one day I almost fell, and then my classmates were like, are you normal? Are you on drugs or something? What is wrong with you? How can you fall asleep while you're standing?
It would take Miriam 5 years to get a diagnosis of narcolepsy.
I was very happy. And like I was in the clear, I'm not lazy.
That diagnosis changed her life. Narcolepsy is one of a host of sleep disorders originating in the brain.
It is important to find out why, because there could be reasons to why that is happening. And if the intervention done early, that might be able to help you.
There are different interventions that are effective on different patients. Medication doesn't work for Marianne. Instead, she has learned to live with a condition. Tasks such as cooking, driving, working, or using public transport can be dangerous because of the risk of falling asleep. But among understanding friends and relatives, she has found support.
It's like self-acceptance. It's on a daily basis. You have to remind myself, this is a condition I'm living with, and I'm not able to control it. So I think that is the major reason why I worked hard for me now in terms of being a graphic designer to employ myself rather than being employed.
And as more information about these disorders becomes available, people living with sleep disorders hope that the rest of the world will wake up to that reality to also offer support and understanding. Wilkis Anyabwa, CGTN.
And coming up in business news. Suez Canal blockage lessens. Experts call for backup plans for global supply chain. And environmentalists push South Africa to increase recycling efforts to help manage waste.
It's new, it's different, it's a challenge.
Woo!
It's
really exciting.
There's more to this place than just glorious landscapes. There's more to it than just, say, Table Mountain or glorious, endless salt flats. There's more to it than countries that are home to some of the deepest minds in the world. There is so much more to this place, even if it is home to some of the finest diamonds on the planet. It is the sheer diversity of the people who call Southern Africa home and the relentless drive to make it a better place and make it so special. And we know that because this too is home. No one knows Southern Africa like we do. CGTN, see the difference.
You don't find the stories of North Africa by sitting on the sidelines. You've got to get out, go there, and you'll find them. In the bazaars of Casablanca. Among the crowds in Cairo.
Who comes to visit Cairo, the ancient capital of Egypt?
Along the waters of the Nile. Along the sands of the Sahara.
No one else will take you where we can in North Africa. No one else will show you what it's all about. CGTN, see the difference.
The disruptions from the Suez Canal blockage have highlighted the problems in global trade. Many countries are now thinking about ways to improve maritime commerce and the supply chain network. Dai Kai tells us more about the waterways blockage and talks with experts about some potential solutions.
The Suez Canal had to suspend operation again on April 6th due to a sudden engine failure of an oil tanker in the passage. Fortunately, the problem was later fixed and canal traffic resumed. But 2 weeks ago, with the congestion caused by the Ever Given, the situation seemed more dire. This is probably the last thing you'd expect when navigating the Suez Canal. A giant container ship ran aground, blocking one of the busiest waterways in the world. Around 200,000 tons and 1,300 feet long, the Ever Given is longer than the Eiffel Tower and nearly as long as the Empire State Building. The frantic effort to get this gigantic vessel refloated took nearly a week. The cause of the accident aside, people now care more about the consequences. We're talking about the backlog of more than 400 vessels, all of which found themselves stuck on either side of the canal, carrying goods such as laptops, cars, crude oil, and even livestock. Around 12% of global trade and 10% of the world's oil is set to pass through the Suez Canal, which partly explains why the price of crude oil surged by over 5% on news of the blockage. A study by German insurer Allianz showed that the blockage could cost global trade $6 billion to $10 billion a week. The past 2 decades have seen a sharp expansion in global trade, with container ship models getting larger and larger to promote higher transport efficiency. But analysts believe that means they inevitably pose bigger risks when they encounter troubles en route to their destination. So what does the accident say about global supply chains, and what can we do about it so things like the Ever Given incident don't happen over and over again?
The blockage rippled through the stock markets, commodities and futures trading worldwide, and events like this will not only delay, but could even terminate the transportation of supply chains on a global scale. We have alternatives via cargo aircraft, highways, and railways. The China-Europe Railway Express, for example, is a great substitute, and demand has seen an obvious surge since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Experts say any future blockages could bring continental supply chains to a screeching halt at any minute, which is why it's essential to have a backup plan. Dai Kai, CGTN.
In South Africa, the focus is once again on reducing the dumping of waste at landfill sites. Although there has been some progress over the years in converting plastics and paper back into raw materials, only is usually recycled. Environmentalists say the country could increase economic opportunities if more waste was repurposed. CGTN's Julie Shire reports.
Industrial recycling rates in South Africa have slumped after several lockdowns. Worryingly, waste management companies have also noticed a spike in single-use plastics.
Globally, there's been a big drive. You see no shopping bags and no straws. A big awareness campaign to reduce single-use plastics because they have such a dire impact on our environment. But with COVID, the rise in PPE, your masks, and all your different types of plastics covering material, we've seen a rise in single-use plastic, which is not good.
South Africa produced around 1.8 million tons of plastic in 2019. Just 500,000 tons was recycled during that time, of which 70% was converted back to raw materials. That may soon increase as government gets tough on rubbish disposal.
We have a new regulation coming in specifically around packaging, which will affect the direct recycling market, the extended producer responsibility regulation, which says producers of materials or products that are packaged need to take more onus on what happens to those products after the consumer has used those.
South Africa's recycling rates are still very low. Over 90% of waste is still dumped in landfills.
$1 billion worth of waste last year was thrown away to landfill, which are actually resources which could have been used into our economy. And in the sense of where South Africa is in terms of economy, those are valuable resources that we could have not only used, but also created jobs.
Waste collectors are vital to South Africa's economy. It's estimated they save municipalities $50 million in landfill space annually.
I'm next to the retails and whatsoever, so cardboard is the one that do well, and the more of aluminium can. Aluminium can, as you can see, I'm around the pubs, yes, and the garages next to me, corporate. Now at least they turn it to be a recyclable material, they can do something and can send to the end user, they do the product.
South Africa is under pressure to increase recycling as landfill space fast diminishes, but municipal solid waste comes from households. But consumers can start helping by separating their trash before dumping it in the bin. Julie Shara, CGTN, Johannesburg, South Africa.
In Uganda, many rural communities are facing challenges in getting water. Only 68% of rural villages have access to a safe water source, according to the Ministry of Water. Now, a non-profit organization is helping rural communities access clean and reliable water using solar-powered digital systems. Isabel Nakiria has more details.
Christian Nachivuka now taps water with a swipe. She's using a digital system that involves loading credit on a token and passing it through a payment system to allow water to flow. Residents pay 2 cents for a 20-liter jerrican of water, which they say is affordable.
They really helped us. We are no longer suffering. We don't even think about having to walk down the well to fetch water.
Christian's family and millions more live in Uganda's water-stressed areas. She says life was tough before water was brought close to her home.
Imagine we used to walk up this hill very early before we go to school every day, yet we would take two routes. Sometimes we ended up being late for school.
According to the Water Ministry, only 38% of the people in Christian's district of Sembabule have access to clean water.
This water source has for years been used by both humans and animals. It's not only safe for drinking, but it's also far off. People have to walk over 2 kilometers to access it.
The government drilled boreholes in the area, but many broke down. Water Campus, an NGO working to improve access to water in rural communities, is modernizing the broken boreholes. It's replacing hand pumps with solar-powered pumps and supplying cheap water closer to where people live.
We also use a solar-powered digital payment system so that people receive an individual token that they can load credit onto, so that at any time during the day or night they can come and collect water without having to disturb anyone to turn on a tap or have to travel far down to a hand pump.
The organization has built three water systems in three districts so far, each costing $30,000. The project leaders say the system is reliable and residents are assured of constant water supply throughout the year. The climate in Zimbabwe is semi-arid, meaning not much rain is received here. The community in Christian's village is lucky, but millions more still don't have access to clean and safe water. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN Zimbabwe, Uganda.
Over to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the government has begun distributing gas cylinders to its population at a subsidized price. The move is meant to discourage the public from using charcoal for cooking. The program, which is in its second phase, is aimed at saving the country's forests. CGTN's Chris Chamringa has more from Kinshasa.
The charcoal trade is a lucrative business in the DRC. Hundreds of sacks of charcoal are transported daily into the capital, Kinshasa, from other parts of the country. The vast majority of residents use charcoal for cooking. Berth Lumumba is a food seller who can't imagine life without it.
Charcoal really helps us to survive. For example, I use it to cook and sell food to many people around here. I have large saucepans which require charcoal stoves to cook well. I can't use any other energy source.
But while charcoal has helped Berth fend for her family, the cutting down of trees has degraded the environment. The government has now partnered with a company called Sogas to distribute low-cost gas cylinders to the public in order to reduce deforestation.
We provided $2 million to Sogas so that in return the population can have access to these tools, to these units. The way we do it here is that we provide the money, Sogas provides the units to the population at a very, very low price because of the subsidies, and then people will start using this gas on a daily basis, and we think thereafter it will discourage those that are cutting trees for charcoals because people are already using gas.
Five provinces with a growing demand for charcoal have been targeted in this project. Othniel Mpata is one of the women who has started using gas.
First of all, gas stoves make cooking fast and easy. Sometimes I get caught up with other work, but when I turn the gas on, my food gets ready in a short time. It's much better than using charcoal.
According to NGO Global Forest Watch, the DRC has lost 6% of its forest cover, mainly due to slash and burn agriculture and the use of charcoal for fuel.
The DRC has struggled to protect its forests from charcoal traders and illegal loggers for decades. Environmentalists fear the cutting down of trees may lead to severe changes in weather patterns if left unchecked. Authorities have vowed to crack down on illegal activities in the forestry industry, but it remains to be seen whether that pledge will be fully implemented. Chris Ochamringa, CGTN, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Join us in global business and see Africa through our eyes.
The greatest journeys, the greatest sights, the greatest adventures.
Here in Sanata, this weir allows the locals to walk on water.
We're far more than just TV news. We're your passport to the wonders of Africa.
To bring you stories of struggle, survival and hope.
So let's explore. CGTN. See the difference.
Now let's take a look at some of the events in the last 7 days in our roundup, World in a Week. Coming up in sports, we look at the success story of Zimbabwe qualifying for the AFCON finals despite financial constraints and the COVID-19 pandemic.
How would you create your legend? On the field. On the tracks. In the arenas of Africa. Were you born to be a player? Could this moment be yours? Sports Scene.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for today, Sunday, April 11th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And, of course, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for this week.
I heard
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April 11th, 2021. That was the music of Memphis Minnie, and if you see my rooster, send him back home. And we're going to have a special focus on the legendary Paul Leroy Robeson, who was born on April 9th of 1898. This is the 123rd anniversary of his birth in the state of New Jersey. And we're going to listen to a documentary on Paul Robeson. Let's listen in.
Until only recently, athlete, actor, singer, and political activist Paul Robeson was one of the most underappreciated human figures of the 20th century. He helped break down racial barriers and ignorance, but accusations of communist affiliations in the 1950s forced him into obscurity for most of his later life until his death from a stroke in 1976. Upstate New York academic and performance artist Ken Anderson has developed a living history of Robeson. WRVO's Mark Lavonier caught up with Ken and brings you this half-hour special featuring actual recordings of the black American whose activities in part led to the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And now, America's Sung Hero, a tribute to Paul Robeson.
When I'd go to a music store to get a book of Negro spirituals, I would find that they were usually cued at a range that was high for me. I think God blessed me with some good pipes. I'm a bass.
I'm singing.
Singing is making sad folks happy. Singing is sweetness in a bitter world. Give us singing, and singing gives us strength.
We're with you there, mister.
And here's a voice that had sung itself into the heart of America, the beauty of America. Here's a voice with all the glory of America, Paul Robeson.
When I'd hear Paul Robeson sing, it's conversational for me. And if you're going to sing a song, study it, learn about it.
When Dvorak, the great Czech composer, was in America, he said, "In the Negro melodies of America, I discover all that is needed for a great and noble school of music. They are pathetic, tender, passionate, melancholy, solemn, religious, bold, merry, gay, gracious, or what you will."
After hearing Paul sing these old familiar songs and some things that I should have known, which he taught me, I got excited about this man. He is my hero. Great, great American hero.
Swing low, sweet chariot, come in for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, come in for to carry me.
So I started to combine the two things of singing Paul's songs, but also talking about a man who had been just maligned and almost they tried to destroy him here in this country. He was the best known man on the planet in the 40s and early 50s, and the climate was such that this government decided that they had to silence him. We're not teaching about him in the history books. I get to travel and sing and talk about black history. And I'll go into any venue and see images of all the famous black civil rights leaders, W.E.B. Du Bois and Sojourner Truth and so forth. No Paul Robeson. And that's white as well as black churches and social institutions, because they maligned him. They called him a communist. And people got frightened about this man. They had to silence him. Born in Princeton, New Jersey, April 9th, 1898. A preacher's kid. His daddy was an escaped slave from North Carolina from a plantation in 1860, fought in the Civil War, made his way to the area where Lincoln University is located, and he finally got a master's of art and a bachelor's of divinity. In those days, they wanted to educate blacks so that they would become ministers, and the thought among some of them was, we'll educate these guys to lead their flocks back to Africa, or certainly to be ministers to serve the colored flock. So the old man ended up called to the Witherspoon Presbyterian Church in Princeton, in New Jersey. Interesting time. A man named Woodrow Wilson was president of Princeton. Subsequently, he moved to Somerville, New Jersey, where he became an AME Zion minister. Paul Robeson grew up as the youngest of five children in Princeton and saw his mother die when the women wore long dresses in those days and caught on fire. So he was raised by his dad and his older brothers. When I do Robeson programs very often, I sing, "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, long ways from home, a long ways from home." Paul was bright. He was exceptional. He was involved in drama and the arts when he was in high school. Wonderful English teacher who coached him. Got to his junior year. He should have taken a competitive exam to qualify to be admitted into a senior college in Jersey. His high school principal didn't like Paul being forward, and he denied him the opportunity to take that exam. He had to take both portions of it in his senior year, but he aced it. And so therefore he was eligible at a time when the old man didn't have money to send him to his alma mater where his brothers and sister had gone. So he was only the second black to be admitted to Rutgers University. He went out for football. He was a big guy. Coach tried him out, and he looked good. His fellow players decided that no way were they going to play with a nigger. That was the term that they used. And they designed a play to run over Paul, and they beat up on him. Broke his nose, damaged his arm, did some bad stuff to him. Paul went back home and said to his pop, "Hey, I can't handle this." And his dad and his brother said, "Hey, you got to." So when he healed and he went back, the same teammates, is not the term, tried to do the same thing again. And he brushed aside one or two guys and got to the guy who would beat up on him. And he bench pressed him. He held him over his head. And the coach said, "Don't you touch him. He's on the varsity." And Paul dropped him on the ground.
"I met my brother the other day. I gave him my right hand. And just as soon as ever my back was turned, he scandalized my name."
Rutgers then, for the first time, began to have a winning seasons in football. In addition, Paul was a giant in terms of his intellectual powers. Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year, was valedictorian in his senior year and graduated summa cum laude. And he played semi-professional football for a year and then went to Columbia University Law School and repeated the process as valedictorian and summa cum laude. When he was at the law firm where one of his classmates had invited him to join, there was a rather infamous case in Harlem that his law firm had gotten, and Paul probably thought that he was going to be there to represent him. He'd done research for the firm for quite some time. Two things happened. One, they decided that no, they wouldn't let Paul represent this prestigious law firm at the bar. And the secretary said that she wouldn't take dictation from a nigger. A good, strong, proud Paul says, bump you, and he left.
You're listening to America's Sung Hero, the life of Paul Robeson told in story and song
Producer Mark Lavonier met with singer and historian Ken Anderson to learn more about Paul, who we now hear in a performance from 1935.
I'd now like to sing and end with that most majestic of Negro folk songs, Go Down Moses.
When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go.
He was really the first prominent artist of his caliber to give concerts solely of Negro spirituals and folk songs, 16 songs. So he was a forerunner in there. I was in special services when I was in the Army in the early 1950s. I got there because they had a competition. I sang Vincent Newman's Without Song and Paul Robeson's Jerome Kern and Hammerstein's Old Man River. As a consequence, I recall being invited by a dentist who lived in Stuttgart who had heard me over the radio. And he put on this record, which was like yay thick, Paul singing Old Man River. The voice was just gorgeous.
Now, 1928, Paul performed Old Man River in the play Showboat on the London stage.
Showboat, which was written, the role of Joe was written with Paul Robeson in mind. He was over in Europe acting at the time.
I wanted to ask you, did he have some great affinity for England, or was he so revered there that he just decided to seize the opportunity to work where people appreciated him?
Well, all Afro-American performers in that time faced gross rank discrimination in this country. They could not really pursue their art in freedom because of the racial discrimination. You had to stay in private homes because you couldn't stay in the hotels. He experienced that when he was in college back at Rutgers, when if he was on the debating team that might be traveling somewhere, they had to find separate accommodations. Once he went to Europe, Paul and everybody else said, hey, I feel free. I feel like a human being, a whole person.
The magic key of RCA turns to Paul Robeson in London, England.
I am so happy to be here through the courtesy of the magic tiara. It does seem like magic when I can sing to the folks at home from such a great distance. My first song is a Negro folk song about Noah and the Ark, the old Ark the Mover.
The old ark to mover in, a mover in, a mover in. Old ark to mover in, a mover in along. The old ark to mover in, a mover in, a mover in. Old ark to mover in, a mover in along.
Now, 1930, he performed in sort of a first, and it received 20 curtain calls, and that was his role as Shakespeare's Othello.
Why is this? Thinks the isle to make a life of jealousy? To follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No. To be once in doubt is once to be resolved. Exchange me for a goat, when I shall turn the business of my soul to such exsufflicate and blown surmises matching thy inference.
I think that Paul stands on the shoulders, in the sense of Shakespearean acting, of this guy who was an expatriate. Ira Aldrich went over to England and to Europe and was renowned as an interpreter of Shakespeare's plays, including Othello. 1920s, and for a black man to perform on an American stage in the role of a Moor, This was a time when Paul and just so many talented people had to go to Europe to be free as an artist and to express themselves. I think Paul stood so tall. Any Afro-American who was sensitive to the racism in this country, you know, it hits you in so many different ways that you've got to respond. Racism is woven into the fabric of our society. In such invidious ways, that you'd have to literally unravel that Constitution, which we revere when you think about the fact that black folk were not even considered as human beings. We were considered as chattel, as property. After the Civil War, we would not have won the Civil War if it hadn't been for the way the black soldiers just literally gave up their lives to fight for their freedom. And we got sold out not too long after that. And Paul grew up in that climate. We were two separate and distinct societies, one white and one black.
There were spirituals and blues that sounded a note of deep protest. For example, how long must my people weep and mourn? Too long, they've been barely mizzing along. And No More, sung at the end of the Civil War, becomes today a song of protest, demanding that the promise of the Emancipation Proclamation be fully realized.
Paul Robeson was a soul voice among black people who were speaking out against the terrible racism in this country.
No more auction block for me. No more, no more, no more auction block for me. Many thousand gone.
There was Paul Robeson, a lone voice out there. They called him a communist because the man was talking about peace and justice and freedom for all people, and especially people who were oppressed. When Hitler was gearing up his weapons of war, Paul Robeson went over and sang on the battlefield to support. They called him a communist. Hitler had rounded up people who were deemed as unfit to live and put them in work camps. Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and the like. Paul sang the foreign surgeon generals. He sang the peat bog soldiers. You know, the Nazis almost ran him out of Germany while he was over there. He was just a Renaissance man, a man ahead of his time.
Now, one of the main forums for Paul to really stand out and grab the attention of Americans was during the Pursuit of Happiness program on November 5th, 1939, when at the end of the program he sang the Ballad for Americans.
And he drew a larger radio listening audience than at Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. I recall as a child hearing that. It's a great statement that I am an American.
Still nobody would anybody believe it. Everybody would anybody, they doubted it. And they are doubting still, and I guess they always will. But who cares what they say when I am on my way?
Hey, will you please tell us who you are?
What's your name, buddy?
Where are you going?
Who are you?
Well, I'm everybody who's nobody. I'm the nobody who's everybody.
What's your racket? What do you do for a living?
Well, I'm an engineer, musician, street cleaner, carpenter, teacher.
How about a farmer?
Also.
In the same year that he performed that, in 1939, he was refused service at a New York restaurant. And then the next year, during his American run of Showboat in 1940, he had trouble finding accommodations in Los Angeles. But during this time, in the top magazines and publications of the day, and the critics named Paul Robeson as the top Negro performer in America, how could he still have such discriminatory hardship after becoming one of the most recognized and celebrated performers, period, regardless of his race or ethnicity?
It didn't matter whether you were a prominent person at the level of a Paul Robeson or just an ordinary citizen. We were all subject to that. I think back to, and I made a reference to this earlier, that a man named Woodrow Wilson, who became president of the United States, when he went down to Washington, D.C., the first thing that he did was to segregate our nation's capital. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, and was born at the Memorial Hospital, where they had a separate delivery room for white women and black women. And in those days, you couldn't buy clothes in the clothing store. You couldn't attend the theaters. You lived usually in the worst portions of town, by the industrial areas, by the railroad tracks. And when you traveled at your hazard. That's what Wilson did. Segregated the whole country. So when a man like Paul would go to Europe or wherever and say, I feel free, I feel like a human being for the first time in my life, and then the right-wingers here accuse him of being an American because he's talking about us overseas.
Now, it was said that during the McCarthy hearings with the House Un-American Activities Committee, he refused to name any names or any affiliation with the Communist Party. And to my understanding, others, to appease the committee, had to renounce Paul Robeson.
They did. It was one of the most sad times in our history when people of goodwill and even some friends of Paul's said, hey, I got a family to raise, I got a career to maintain, and they spoke out against him. So many people got caught up in that terrible situation.
Now, in and around that time, Paul was speaking about the plight of the black soldier at the Paris Congress of the World Partisans of Peace to his message of unity at rallies he would hold in Harlem. What really made history is what is known as the Peekskill riots. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what happened.
Only from what I've been personally informed by two people, Ella Mazel, who was a part of a youth group that was there setting up the tables in preparation for Paul to come up and give this concert, when some thugs started to overturn the tables and disrupt the situation. And from a man named Pete Seeger, who was there with his young wife and baby at the time.
You won't get the true story from the daily press or the radio, so we're putting it on record for you now. Here are the facts.
You are invited to a summer concert with Paul Robeson, Pete Seeger, Hope Foy, Joan Schlesinger, and George Walker for the benefit of the Harlem chapter of the Civil Rights Congress, Sunday, August 27, 1949, at the Lakeland Picnic Grove, Peekskill, New York.
Robeson was in a caravan coming up from New York City, and the people who preceded him, when they got to a certain point, they were directed by New York State Police toward the area where the concert was to be held. But there were a group of local folks who had been recruited to throw bricks and stones and building blocks and stuff at these people. And it was in collusion with the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the State Police, and the Ku Klux Klan. Now that's a hell of a powerful force, I tell you.
More facts. Police protection was asked. Four deputies showed up to watch 700 so-called veterans attack the early picnickers. These 700 hoodlums closed the only exits, and for 3 hours, they were kept from killing the women and children by a brave group of 39 men and boys, Negro and white.
And the thing about it is that none of those organizations have ever apologized for that horrible blight on our history. That concert was aborted in August. It subsequently was performed in September.
Well, we did go back on September 4th, and we went back 25,000 strong. While 4,000 trade unionists, most of them real veterans, formed a protective guard, we held our concert with Paul Robeson and Pete Seeger, and it was a beautiful day, a fine performance, and a victory for all Americans.
We must keep fighting until we're tired, and old man River is just keep rolling on.
After the Peekskill incident, Paul Robeson spoke out against the Korean War. It was in this year, 1950, that he got his passport taken away.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even allowed in Canada, where you didn't even need a passport.
And for either 3 or 4 successive years, he would stand on the border between the United States and Canada and sing across the border to 40,000 people gathered on the other side because we had taken away his passport. They had suggested, Paul, if you be an apostate and say all the right things, we'll give you back your passport. And the man of courage and conviction said, no way.
All of us with one heart, with the torch of freedom, march on. With the torch of freedom, march on, march on, march on and on.
Again, from being the highest paid performer in the world, they reduced his income and denied him access to any public performing stage. He could sing at the black churches, even there. The ministers were threatened with taking away their tax exemptions. That's what he was limited to.
What were those concerts called that were on the border, the U.S.-Canada border?
Peace Arch Park concerts. Paul spoke on behalf, sang on behalf, advocated on behalf of the common man around the world. But we were in a course, I guess, about the Cold War, and Paul's voice couldn't be tolerated. Paul was over in Russia, and he was invited to a party. The CIA had been messing around with a chemical that was a derivative of LSD, which they were trying to give to foreign leaders who didn't go along with our policies. And they gave some of this stuff to Paul. Somebody spiked his drink, and he took it and went back to his room and cut his wrist. It is alleged that the doctors who treated him were CIA operatives. They flew him to London and put him in a priory, and they gave him 57 convulsive shock treatments, try to wipe out his brain. I know that he was scheduled to meet with Castro, and the Bay of Pigs was in the process. That perhaps might be why that meeting was aborted by him given that drug. He was never the same after that. He spent the last 10 years of his life living with his school teacher sister in West Philadelphia. Paul was a Renaissance man. He just all that. And I just love and admire and respect what he stood for. And the tragedy to me is that it's not taught. It's not in the history books. It's not taught in the schools. Eventually, when I get to colleges and universities, there's an eager audience. But the blessing for me is when I can get into a junior high school or junior college and talk to young people about Paul. I'm old now, but I feel this is my mission. It's a ministry for me to sing the spirituals. It's a mission to talk about Paul Robeson. I wish that, in that sense, that there were a few dozen Afro-American men who would sing Robeson songs and to talk about Paul and the greatness of Paul and his commitment to democratic principles in this country.
Certain word, democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, a plot of earth, a street, grocer and the butcher and the people that I meet, children in the playground, faces that I see, all races, all religions, that's America to me. But especially the people, that's America to me.
America's Sung Hero, a tribute to Paul Robeson, was produced and edited by Mark Lavonier.
Special thanks to Kenneth Anderson, Chris Ulanowski, and Kurt and Brad of the St. Thomas Episcopal Church in Bath, New York. Questions or comments can be sent via email to mark@wrvo.fm. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back. And that was a documentary on Paul Robeson. Next, we're going to hear excerpts from the testimony of Paul Robeson before the United States Senate in 1948. Of course, Robeson being an acclaimed artist and actor and social commentator in the United States, of course, fell victim to the Cold War, particularly after 1947, 48, 49, 1950, his passport was taken, as was mentioned in the last audio documentary. Let's listen to the type of questioning that Robeson was subjected to by the United States Senate in 1948.
Is Mr. Robeson here now?
Yes, I am.
All right, you may take the chair. Will you raise your right hand, please? You do solemnly swear, in the matter now pending before this committee, you'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I'm here, Senator. I've been traveling a good deal about the country on various missions. I'm an artist, a singer. Also, I've been in the South and the West, all over helping and singing for certain charitable organizations. And coming to the bill, I see first is to protect the United States against so-called American subversive activities, I presume, since the United States doesn't exist in abstraction, that it means the people of the United States. That would be more or less all right, wouldn't it?
I would think so.
I'll get back to other sections of the bill. It says in the section 2, the second paragraph, that in the question of the necessity for the legislation, that it's necessary to establish and set up a totalitarian dictatorship in any country results in the ruthless suppression of all opposition to the party in power. This is what I'm interested in, this complete subordination of the rights of individuals to the state, the denial of fundamental rights and liberties which are characteristic of a representative form of government, such as freedom of speech, the press, of assembly, of religious worship, and result in the maintenance of control over the people through fear, terrorism, and brutality. I've been all over the United States speaking and attempting to speak, and I have been experiencing in our own country today this very thing of control over the people through fear, terrorism, and brutality. This is happening in all parts of this land. Now, it seems to me if we're protecting the people of the United States, that these protections are necessary from quite another point of view than I can see in their so-called necessity in this.
Well, do you believe that they are
I'm saying these
entitled to protection even as provided in this bill?
And I also again want to say that it says that
this man wasn't here. We let him into his place.
The complete subordination, the same paragraph, complete subordination of the rights of individuals to the state, denial of fundamental rights and liberties and so forth. I think that this is a complete, for example, a definition, since our states are sovereign powers, so to speak, except for the rights delegated to the federal government. A complete description of, say, what happens to the Negro people today in Mississippi, Alabama, many other states of the Union. And the necessity for legislation, it seems to me, I will go into what I consider the constitutionality, the denial of civil rights under this bill, in fact, to the whole question of the way we have placed this whole question in the bill. But it seems to me that the necessity for legislation that might concern, I suggest, with the committee today and for some time to come, that since in this bill, perhaps hundreds, thousands of Americans would like to speak on it, and that it should, that not only today, but perhaps in the future, there should be opportunity for that. I am tremendously interested, before approaching in detail this bill, just to ask you a question as to why, in the light of the terror that I've seen and the denial of rights, that the lynching bill is not sort of before the Senate at this time. It hasn't come out of the committee.
I couldn't answer that. I'm personally trying to get it out of the committee.
I think that that if there are any kind of activities that strike at the very basis of our democratic way of life, that that this bill certainly should come out. Both parties have gone on record for the civil rights of the Negro people, and it looks as though we might get through without it. So I'm certainly hoping that this bill will come out, and perhaps even this bill could be put aside for the moment and extended later to see that these rights should be should be guaranteed. Now, as for a bill, I see it, the whole question of protecting the rights of the people of the United States, against the background, and the whole question of communism, for example, which is brought in every minute.
Robinson,
can I go on to my question? I'll answer that in just a second.
Are you a member of the
Communist? I will answer that in just a moment. Can I go on to my discussion?
Yes.
I will answer that. The whole background, I would say so, I would strike at the very root of the conception of what is in these first paragraphs. For example, the world movement with its origins and so forth. I mean, does Mr. Monk, or whoever framed the bill, understand that the origins of this kind of thing were in, say, the English Industrial Revolution and the time of Robert Owen, in the roots of the poverty of England, which was responsible for the English poor and indentured servants coming to build America itself? This doesn't just spring up the other day in some part of Europe, a part of the whole struggle of human beings to improve their lot. One of the most important sections for myself being my own people here, the Negro people in America. So I see the whole framework of the bill, in reality, from my travels about this country and otherwise about the world, in the framework of what we understand as Americans, of what we mean by our democratic ways of life here, as expressed in this paragraph, that it means certainly from our own American history, from the beginning of our struggle for freedom from England, down through the Civil War which freed my own people, it means through the New Deal an extension. We mean an extension of the democratic rights and full citizenship to people who do not yet have them. That would include not only one-tenth of the population, the Negro people, it would include, for example, many of the Spanish-American people that I saw in Pueblo, Colorado a few months ago, practically living in hovels under the ground. Would include many in the fruit fields of California, in the whole deep south and all over America. But in approaching this whole problem of the struggle today in Europe and elsewhere, what has happened in 1970 in Russia, what's happened in Yugoslavia in many places, it has to do with trying, with millions and millions of people who are denied very basic rights, economic, social, and political, of building, of trying to build a decent way of life. Against it have been many forces, the most important of which we joined hands against, the forces of fascism. Now, in going about America today, I say that those, when I was in Kansas City and I see the police beating workers over the head because they want a decent living, terrorizing the Negro people in West Virginia and all over, I say these are the essence of ISIS trying to stop the struggle of the people to get the democratic rights which they don't have. And I go so far as to say that I feel, I've been in the Mr. Munn state in South Dakota, I was attacked by him once when I sang there, that in the whole discussion, and we can take it up in detail, of defining what is a communist party, what is a front organization, and what has happened in fact throughout America, where they have terrorized people from joining any kind of liberal struggle.
Right.
Just a second. That this bill has, seems to me, to have as its basic idea not to help the people of the United States or any other people, but to actually stop the struggle by terrorizing people to get rights for Negro people, for workers, and for other Americans who still haven't full citizenship.
You read the bill, Mr.
I have read the bill.
All right, now, Section 4, Paragraph 1. The certain acts that are prohibited are in Section 4.
Well, they've been
the other is merely registration.
No, but you can't dismiss the rest of the bill.
Well, I'm not dismissing it. I'm talking about that part.
Yes, okay.
Do you believe that it should be unlawful for anyone to attempt to establish in the United States a totalitarian dictatorship, the direction and control of which is to be vested in or exercised by or under the domination or control of any foreign government?
We have
foreign organization or foreign individual?
We have laws that take care of
that. But wait a minute.
Of course not. You think
that that should be the law?
Sure, that's all. We have laws to protect that.
What is the law
now? We have plenty of laws to take care of any people who would attempt to overthrow this government.
No, but what is
Mr. Hoover can take care of that.
Wait. That's by force or violence, the Smith Act that you're talking about.
Okay.
Well, this isn't by force or violence. You could do it by other means.
What other means, then?
Well, penetration. You don't think that Yugoslavia wasn't taken over by the communists, do you, Mr. Robson?
I certainly do not. I think the Yugoslav, I say this is very basic.
In Czechoslovakia?
By no means. Let's stick to Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
Czechoslovakia. You can check this up. I happened to be in Czechoslovakia in 1945 singing to American troops at the very end of the war. I, as a singer, was called in by the American military to sing to some Czechs at a big park. And I had been in Prague before the war, and I speak the language a little bit. And I was trying to find out who these Czechs were. So finally, a woman comes up to me and said, I'm Countess so-and-so-and-so, and I met you in Chicago during the war. I said, you were in Chicago during the war, I understand. And I suppose you expect to, and it occurred to me that maybe she was back in Czechoslovakia to get back a couple of those castles, which had been taken away because those who owned the castles had helped the fascists. All I can say is, and I say this, and I can be called up again on this, I felt that I saw the American military, the only Czechs in the room happened to turn out to be Czech collaborationists and Sudeten Germans. And I would say that the Czech people probably made a decision that under no pressure, even American pressure, would they accept the restoration of Czech fascism, that they, if they were made to choose, they would choose the other way. That's the way I would suggest.
So you
as far as Yugoslavia, it seems to me, I was in Yugoslavia, and I saw the Yugoslav peasants suffering exactly like the Negro peasants suffered in the South. Only they were not one-tenth of the population, they were perhaps nine-tenths of the population. And so when we helped them destroy fascism, including King Peter, whom we now seem to have in this country floating around, I know him as a boy there in London, saw him around there, I think that that what has happened in Yugoslavia came from the struggles of the Yugoslav people who, with our help, were able to take the power. And as far as I can see, Senator, they're going to keep it.
All right. Mr. Robson, what is an American communist?
You define that. I consider an American communist.
For
example, I know one. He grew up with me. We came up together. He went to Amherst. I went to Rutgers. I was interested in that because Judge Stone, I took law at Columbia University. He was the dean of personal property at the time. He was an Amherst man who played football. We used to talk about this. Now, this fellow grew up with me, was born in Georgia, went through all sorts of, as a Negro boy, injustices and injury to his dignity every 5 minutes. He came north, went to Harvard Law School, and a dear friend of mine through all my life, still is. He is today on the city council of New York City, a man who is fighting and has made a tremendous struggle for the rights of the Negro people in Harlem and all through the United States. And I know no American that I'm prouder to know, and he is an American communist on the earth.
All right, now what do they stand for?
They stand, as far as I can see, for complete equality of the Negro people in America, which I would like to see in every respect. It might interest me either to know, but in going about the country, I asked university students, when did they think that the Negro people would be completely free in America, like anybody else, not special freedoms, economic, some kind of special freedoms. They said to me, 1,000 years, 1,000 years. So I'm interested in a party and in people who like in the Scottsboro case, who risk their lives, who make every effort of any possible kind to see that the Negro people secure their rights, so the forces of labor...
Do you think that's what communism stands for in America?
It stands for me. Look,
I say, this is my basic point, sir.
Well, that's what I want to
say. My basic
out.
Point is, that, wait, let's just wait a minute. Where did communism come from? I'm taking from the first paragraph. It started against the background of the sufferings of the English people in the mills, in the great industrial revolution, which resulted in the slavery of my people in America. Now, in this struggle, can I say something? In this struggle, as I would put it, of the few against the many in history, that is, why did we found the American government? What happened? Why did Cromwell come over in England in 1620, 1640? Because he said no divine right of kings. And in order to see that in English history, they had to chop off Charles's head. And we had to have a revolution in 1776. We had to have a civil war to see that somewhere people begin to get their rights. So the French Revolution. So I see history as a struggle of the great mass of people to some way get some fair return for their labor and a decent chance to live.
Yes,
now
let's
what's
get
going
down
on in America, sir.
Yes, let's get down to what American communism.
Well, I'm saying to me, it's they are a part of this whole struggle. The interest. So I can only define it against its background.
All right.
You can't say one breath, Senator, that it's American communism, offshoot of Russian communism.
Well, that's what I want to know.
I say, I know. What
is it under the domination?
I say, what is Russian communism an offshoot of? Did Marx or Lenin or these, did this spring up out of the head of Athene? No. These came out of the social conditions of Europe. Now, and communism began in England, not in Russia.
Well,
and let me say, Senator
Robson, are you an American communist?
Just let me finish the point. I'll answer the question. Now, in Scandinavia today, they have decided to solve these problems of all the resources of the nation being in the hands of a few people by cooperative methods. That is, the General Electric, which controls electricity in this country, they more or less put them out of Sweden by cooperative means. In England today, they have taken over the railroads, coal, banks, by socialist means. That is, by public ownership. Now, this oughtn't be any mystery to the American people. We have TVA. New Zealand is a socialist country. This is a part of the struggle of people to get control of some of the wealth instead of leaving it in the hands of a few. I see communism as nothing but an extension of great public ownership of the main means of resources, like the railroad workers said the other day, the coal mines, if they're that important, Senator, to the United States, that every time there's a national emergency, this is life or death to the American people, doesn't it occur to you that instead of beating the workers on the head, that maybe the government should own the railroads and the coal mines? Well, this is a whole struggle of which communism is a part. This is a part of the conceptions of the struggles of human beings for ages. And you can't move communism out anywhere in the world.
Well, then, do I understand?
So American communism is, you might as well say, is American socialist.
Well,
that's an American Democrat.
American communism is part of the Russian system.
No, but do you know that American democratic principles stem directly from the French Revolution and our own revolution? They are very revolutionary ideas.
Right.
In fascist Greece today, these are very revolutionary.
Mr. Robson, let's get down to some of the facts in the bill. Now, I asked you the question, you said you'd answer it. Are you an American communist?
Today, Senator Ferguson, that question has become the very basis of the struggle for American civil liberties. 19 or more, and many of the most some of the most brilliant and distinguished Americans are about to go to jail for failure to answer that question, and I'm going to join them if necessary. I refuse to answer
all
the
right.
question.
You refuse to answer. You refuse to.
This is an invasion of my right of secret ballot, Senator Ferguson. If you want to know whether I am the Communist Party is a legal party, like the Democratic Party, Republican Party. I'm going to vote pretty soon. If you want to send some government official to take my ballot away, a secret ballot, my constitutional right, he can see just what I am.
I see. Have you a communist card in any communist organization, any state, Mr. Robson?
That is, I consider, a part of the other question that I refuse to answer.
Yeah, I see.
And it's a party then that doesn't disclose it.
That's what I want to get
at. Maybe if I were a Republican, maybe I wouldn't disclose it either. I would say, come to the ballot box and see it. I'm not interested what the Republicans do. All I know, the Communist Party is a legal party in the United States and making a magnificent struggle on many fronts.
I mean, communists just refuse to disclose their members of it.
Well, I say, this goes to the very heart of the bill. I say that this whole hysteria and the bill is a part of that hysteria. To use this, not only to hurt communists, but really to break the civil liberties of every section of the American people. The rights of labor, the rights of liberals.
This is
a very basic.
You know something about the communists of America. You know something about the communists of America.
I have many dear friends who are perfectly true.
And you know.
I think they've
done
a magnificent job.
But isn't yes? You
that's
think
right.
they've done a magnificent
right.
job in America? That's your
right.
opinion.
That's my opinion.
And do you know that it is a fact that they, outside of their membership, decline to disclose that they are communists?
Well, I think that they might be. This can be determined. The Supreme Court's going to have to rule on that, I think.
But no, isn't that a fact? That except
know.
Among themselves, they decline to make it public that they are communist or not communist.
I would say that if it weren't a basic problem of civil liberties that goes to the very heart of the struggle, and of which the denial of these civil liberties, of which I believe this bill to be a part, that's the reason I'm here. This would not be so at all.
Have you ever been to Russia?
Oh, yes.
And have you studied in Russia?
Oh, no, never studied there. I went there as
You never attended any of the...
As far as that's concerned, you don't have to go to Russia to read Marx or Lenin.
No, I understand.
They didn't give it to me at Rutgers, incidentally, where I went to college, but I read it.
Yeah, but you've read it since.
That's right.
You didn't study in any school in Russia.
No.
Do you know...
I went in purely as an artist. And knew nothing about them. My first went in 1934, nothing about them.
Do you know the head of the Communist Party in Russia, Mr. Stalin? Do you know...
No, I never met Mr. Stalin.
You've never met him? How much time have you spent in Russia?
I was there for over a period, let's say between 34 and 37. I was there 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months. What is much more interesting, I should think, Senator, is that my boy went to school there for 2 or 3 years. My one boy.
Your boy?
Because I found in Russia a complete absence of race prejudice.
Yes.
A complete absence.
What's the name
of the... The first time in my life, Senator, that I was able to walk the earth with complete dignity as a human being. So I took my boy there. He's now at Cornell.
Yes.
And let me tell you what happened to him.
What age was he?
He was 8 or 9 years old.
Well, he was just
a boy. Very important age, incidentally.
Yes?
Very important.
What school did he attend?
He went to a school in Moscow, a public school. Public school.
Yes.
Now, he's in Cornell. He's been back in America many years, went to high school. But in Russia, from not experiencing this race prejudice, today in America, he's going to fight for his people and fight in the progressive section of American life with a much easier than I can, for example. Because if somebody would suddenly call me a name here in the room, I don't think I would do anything about it, but I'm sure I'd have a tendency to get up and want to knock the guy down. Now, he has no feeling of any kind of thing, because he knows that he lived in a part of the world where there was no such thing as color prejudice. So he's going to be able to make a very important contribution, I think, to American life. This is what it did for him. That's the reason he went.
Do you know whether or not the American communist owes any allegiance to the red flag?
As far as I know, the Supreme Court has been put up only once. They refused to pass on it.
No, I'm asking what you know.
You've
been traveling all over.
I don't know. Why would they? Why that? As far as I know, the American communist is interested in improving, as far as possible, certainly, the lot of the people here, of the people who suffer, as well as in other parts of the world where this becomes a struggle.
Do you know whether or not the American communists believe in world revolution?
That I don't know.
You don't know that.
That I don't know.
And do you know whether they do believe in allegiance to the Communist Party or communism in Russia? That they owe allegiance to?
No. I don't think that. I would say no from anything I know about it. I don't think they have nearly as much allegiance to Russia as certain Americans seem to have today, say, to a fascist Greece or to Turkey or to Abdullah in Transjordania.
You have addressed communist meetings in America, have you?
President Roosevelt gave a definition of this, that of the concentration of power in a few hands in the struggle of the New Deal against the so-called economic royalists, in which he defined this concentration of power as the essence of fascism.
I would like Mr. Hoover to be sure he's got Mr. DuPont tabbed and Forrestal and the people. This is very difficult because they are our government today. It isn't so easy to get to the basis of what might be potential American fascism. That's what frightens me. And I don't see enough about that in the bill.
Well, doesn't this bill cover dictatorship, whether it be fascist or communist?
You cannot define fascism or communism by totalitarian dictatorship. I disagree with this again is misleading the American people. That is, during the wars.
What's your definition of fascist?
I would say, to me, the essence of fascism it, in two things. Let's take the more obvious one first. Racial superiority. The kind of racial superiority that led a Hitler to wipe out 6 million Jewish people, that can result any day in the lynching of Negro people in the South or other parts of America, the denial of their rights, the constant daily denial to any Negro in America, no matter how important, whoever may be, of his essential human dignity, the things which no other American would accept. This daily insult to his dignity as a human being. This is the essence of fascism.
The
most important thing, which is the reason this can be, is the power of the resources of a nation in the hands of a few, and the use of the state power, as Hitler or Mussolini or the police in Kansas City, to beat down any attempt to strive toward any kind of democratic rights or freedoms.
Even though that be law enforcement?
What's that?
Even though it be law enforcement?
This is the very essence of the thing. We find always that law enforcement in this case is the protection of the property of the few people who are the potential of fascism.
Now, what is the essence of communism in America, in your opinion?
The essence, to my mind, of communism here anywhere is every day I read in the paper, what does communism do?
Welcome back, and that was excerpts from testimony before the United States Senate by Paul Robeson in 1948, and of course, that's going to conclude our program for today, the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit for Sunday, April 11th, 2021. We want to remind our listeners, if you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, all you need to do is go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to this program so you can listen to it again or share with other potential listeners, all you have to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And the programs can be shared with other listeners by merely copying and pasting the links and, of course, sharing those links with other potential listeners as well. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week. We'll be right back.